Hello everyone, and welcome to the History of Scotland podcast, episode 50, Living Up to a Legacy. I'm your host Fraser, and today's episode marks a significant milestone in our journey through Scotland's storied past. Before we dive into the heart of our narrative, I'd like to share a personal update and extend a heartfelt thank you to all of you for your continued support and enthusiasm for Scottish history. Firstly, I owe you an explanation for my recent absence. The past few weeks have been, well, quite challenging. I've been battling an illness that left me without a voice and quite literally coughing my guts up, proper Black Death medieval style. It's not been a pleasant time, but thankfully I'm now back to full health and eager to resume our exploration of Scotland's rich and complex history. I appreciate your patience and understanding during this period, and I'm excited to announce that, well, to make up for the missed episode last month, because if you remember I always say I'll release 3 episodes a month, we'll be releasing a total of 4 episodes this March. This will bring us to the conclusion of William I's illustrious reign, a chapter of our history that has been both fascinating and pivotal. But wait, there's more. On to a celebratory note, this is our 50th episode. Reaching this milestone is a testament to the stories that have shaped Scotland and the community we've built together through this podcast. To mark this occasion, as previously mentioned in the last episodes, we'll be hosting a special Q&A episode next time. This is your chance to ask anything you'd like, whether it's about me, the series, the future of the podcast, Scottish history, general history, or anything else that piques your curiosity. I've already received some intriguing questions and I'm looking forward to addressing them in our upcoming special episode. So, how do you participate? How do you ask these questions? Well, for Spotify listeners, you can use the Q&A function available underneath this episode. There's a little section where you can leave a question and it'll say like, how do you feel about this episode or something like that. You can leave comments there. Feel free to do, any Spotify listeners, and I can put that into the Q&A for next episode. Any Podbean listeners are encouraged to leave a comment under the episode on the Podbean app or on the website. And for listeners on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or any other podcasting platforms, feel free to either email your questions to historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com, that is historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com, comment on this episode post on our Facebook group, or even make a post on the Facebook group, your choice, or finally you can obviously tweet me at thehistoryofse1, that is at thehistoryofse1. Your questions and engagement with this podcast add depth and perspective to our discussions, and I'm genuinely excited to engage with your inquiries in our next episode. Anyhow, let's turn our pages back to, well, a few weeks ago. In our last episode, we delved into the dynamics of key noble families during William's reign, exploring their standings and relationships with the king. We uncovered the composition of William's Council of Nobles, identified his closest allies, and examined how the Gaelic nobles perceived him. These insights set the stage for today's focus, where we pivot back to the broader political narrative surrounding Scotland's quest for independence from England under the new English king, Richard I. We'll explore William's strategies and successes in reclaiming Scotland's rights, quelling the final revolts of his reign, including bringing the infamous Galloway under heel with the son of his friend Uhtred. So, as always, grab yourself a hot drink, turn up the volume on your radio or headphones, and join me as we journey back to the time of William I, a period that not only tested the resilience and integrity of Scotland's leaders, but also laid the groundwork for the nation's enduring legacy of independence and growth. Let's continue our exploration of Scotland's captivating history together. The Treaty of Falaise, signed in December 1174, stands as a pivotal moment in the reign of William I of Scotland, casting a long shadow over his sovereignty and the autonomy of the Scottish Kingdom. This agreement, forced in the aftermath of William's capture at the Battle of Alnwick by forces loyal to Henry II of England, effectively placed Scotland under English overlordship as we knew. The treaty not only demanded a hefty ransom for William's release, but also required the fealty of Scottish nobles to Henry, alongside the handover of key Scottish castles such as Edinburgh, Stirling, and Roxburgh to English control. The implications of this treaty were profound, influencing William's reign and his subsequent actions in profound ways. He obviously got back Edinburgh in the dowry due to his marriage, but still, Roxburgh, Stirling were in English control, as well as Berwick. The Treaty of Falaise was more than a mere diplomatic agreement. It was a symbol of Scotland's subjugation to English power. The loss of independence and the requirement to swear fealty to Henry II were seen as humiliating concessions, reducing William from a sovereign king to what some might view as a vassal of England. This status was deeply damning, not only to William, but to the Scottish people and nobility who valued their kingdom's autonomy and resented Norman Anglo-English interference. The presence of English garrisons in Scottish castles served as a constant reminder of this subjugation, undermining William's authority within his own realm. William's desire to regain Scottish independence was driven by a combination of personal pride, political necessity, and national sentiment. Accepting the status quo would mean continuing to rule as an English lackey, a position to the fiercely independent Scottish nobility and detrimental to William's legitimacy as king. Moreover, the economic and strategic disadvantages imposed by the treaty, such as the loss of control over crucial fortifications and the obligation to pay a large ransom, further galvanised William's resolve to overturn its terms. This determination to restore Scotland's sovereignty guided William's diplomacy and military strategy in the years following the treaty. William understood that direct military confrontation with Henry was a futile, given the disparities in power and, well, the armies available. Instead, he opted for a mere nuanced approach, seeking alliances with Henry's enemies and exploiting the political dynamics within England and Europe to strengthen his position. William's efforts were aimed at creating a political environment conductive and conducive to renegotiating the terms of the treaty, with the ultimate goal of restoring Scotland's independence. William's drive to regain this independence was not solely motivated by a desire to erase the humiliation of the treaty, though. The independence was crucial for Scotland's economic development, political stability, and international relations. By freeing Scotland from English overlordship, William aimed to secure a future in which Scotland could forge its own path again, make its own alliances, and develop its economy without English interference. The treaty was a turning point in William's reign, representing not only a moment of significant defeat, but also the catalyst for a relentless pursuit of independence. This episode in Scottish history underscores the complexity of medieval geopolitics and the lengths to which leaders would go to secure the nation's sovereignty. William's eventual success in regaining Scotland's independence, though, through diplomacy rather than outright conflict, highlights his political acumen and the enduring Scottish desire for self-determination. Transitioning from the internal struggles and diplomatic manoeuvres of William of Scotland, our narrative shifts the focus to the other side of the Anglo-Scottish border, with the ascension of a certain Richard the Lionheart, that is, Richard I, to the English throne, a pivotal moment that would significantly impact Scotland's quest for independence. The transition of power in England from Henry II to Richard marked a new chapter in Anglo-Scottish relations, one that would eventually lead to a drastic alteration in the dynamics established by the treaty. Henry II, one of the most formidable and influential monarchs of the Plantagenet dynasty, died on the 6th of July 1189. His reign was marked by significant legal and administrative reforms that laid the groundwork for the English common law system. However, Henry's final years were overshadowed by the familial discord and rebellion. His relationships with his sons, particularly Richard and John, were fraught with tension and conflict, culminating in a series of revolts against his rule. One of such revolts is which obviously our friend and our ruler, William, got himself embroiled in. Henry's death was not only the end of an era, but also the culmination of a prolonged period of internal strife and rebellion that weakened his position and health, paving the way for Richard's ascension to the throne. Richard the Lionheart was the third of Henry II's sons to become king, succeeding his father in 1189. The path to Richard's ascension was shaped by the premature death of his older brothers, Henry the Young King and Geoffrey II, Duke of Brittany. Henry the Young King, who had been crowned during his father's lifetime in a rare example of junior kingship, predeceased Henry II in 1183, extinguishing his claim to the throne. This left Richard as the eldest surviving son and the primary heir to the English crown. Henry the Young King's early death was a turning point in the Plantagenet succession drama. His rebellion against his father, along with his untimely demise, removed a potential competitor for Richard, and the simplified line of succession was made. Upon Henry II's death, Richard was already a seasoned military leader and a central figure in the rebellions against his father, which, paradoxically, both strained and solidified his claim to the throne. Upon ascending the throne, Richard's immediate priorities were influenced by his martial ambitions and the need for resources to support his planned participation in the Third Crusade. His outlook on Scotland and the existing arrangements under the Treaty of Alluce was shaped by these broader objectives. Unlike his father, whose policies towards Scotland were driven by a desire for dominance and control, Richard was more inclined towards securing financial and military support for his crusade. This pragmatic approach led him to reassess the value of continued overlordship over Scotland in light of the pressing need for crusade funds. Richard's view of Scotland was thus marked by a willingness to negotiate and make concessions that his father might not have considered. The heavy burdens imposed on Scotland by the Treaty of Alluce presented an opportunity for Richard to extract a substantial sum in exchange for the restoration of Scottish independence. This approach was not born out of any particular affinity for Scotland, but rather a clear-eyed assessment of his priorities and the geopolitical realities of the time. The transition from Henry to Richard marked a significant shift in the English attitudes towards Scotland. Richard's ascension to the throne opened a door for this re-evaluation of the Anglo-Scottish relationship, setting the stage for, well, the tale of Scotland's independence to come. The period leading to the end of Scotland's subjugation under the Treaty of Alluce intertwines closely with Richard's need for financial resources, as I've mentioned. Richard, and he would soon be known as the Lionheart, was deeply committed to the Christian cause in the Holy Land. His fervent desire to lead a crusade to recapture Jerusalem from Muslim control necessitated a substantial fund and war chest, far beyond the regular income of the English crown, including the Plantagenet Empire that was under his rule. The logistics of mounting such a vast army expedition, including the need to equip, transport soldiers, horses, and supplies over great distances, required a colossal amount of money. This financial pressure motivated Richard to seek funds through various means, including selling titles, rights, and properties, and imposing taxes. However, these measures were insufficient to cover the Crusade's enormous costs. The Third Crusade, which would be a major military expedition planned by Richard in alliance with Philip II of France and other European monarchs, its primary goal was to reconquer the Holy Land, particularly Jerusalem, which had fallen to the Muslim leader Saladin in 1187 AD. The crusade was not only a matter of religious devotion, but also a means for Richard to assert his military prowess and leadership on the international stage. The endeavour represented the medieval Christians' world response to the loss of Jerusalem, considered a catastrophic defeat for Christendom. Richard's commitment to the crusade was both a personal crusade vow and a political move to elevate his status among European monarchs. And this is something, including the entirety of the Third Crusade and Scotland's participation in it, and what soldiers and lords participated in the crusade, will be covered in not next week's episode, because obviously that's a Q&A, but the episode after that. So before we end William's reign, yes, we will be doing a crusade catch-up and discussing what's gone on in the Holy Land, what happens in the Third Crusade, and what participation Scotland took in it. So you've got a lot to look forward to. Anyway, if we look back to England, understanding Richard's urgent need for funds shed light on his decision to invite William in 1189 to London, shortly after becoming King of England. This invitation marked a significant moment, offering a potential shift in oppression dynamics established by the treaty. For William, the meeting represented a rare opportunity to negotiate the terms of Scotland's autonomy directly with the English monarch, possibly leveraging Richard's financial desperation to Scotland's advantage. From William's perspective, several thoughts and considerations might have been at play as he prepared for this meeting. There was a likely cautious optimism, tempered by the knowledge of the delicate balance of power and the historical context of English-Scottish relations. William would have been acutely aware of the significance of this meeting for the future of Scotland's independence and the potential to reverse the humiliations of the Treaty of Valence. However, alongside optimism, there would have been wariness about the terms of any agreement and the potential for further English demands or betrayals. The meeting between Richard and William was thus not just a diplomatic formality, but a crucial negotiation with the potential to radically alter the course of Scottish history. It was a moment fraught with the tension and possibility, underpinned by the broader geopolitical ambitions of the English crown and the personal determination of the Scottish king to restore his nation's sovereignty. So, we arrived to the landmark moment in Anglo-Scottish relations, which arrived on the 5th of December 1189. Richard I, driven by his imminent departure for the Third Crusade and a disposition towards William I of Scotland marked differently from that of his father, Henry II, agreed to a groundbreaking accord. This agreement, known as the Quit Claim of Canterbury, effectively dismantled the Treaty of Valence, liberating Scotland from the conditions that had significantly curtailed its sovereignty. The Quit Claim of Canterbury represented a significant departure from the previous era of Scottish dominion over Scotland. Richard's willingness to nullify the treaty was heavily influenced by his urgent need for funding to support the crusade. This necessity for financial resources made him more amenable to negotiations with William, leading to a mutually beneficial agreement. In exchange for the substantial sum of 10,000 silver marks, which was equivalent to approximately 6,500 at the time, a massive sum in today's money, Richard agreed to restore Scottish independence, a sum that, while considerable, was a price William deemed worth paying for his kingdom's autonomy. And the Davidonian Revolution helped pay this, due to the Normanisation of much of the Scottish lands and the centralisation, William was able to pull together a lot of this money. The conditions of the Quit Claim were notable for the explicit renunciation of the demands imposed by the treaty. William, in a ceremonial gesture, did homage to Richard for his dignities in England, in a manner similar to that of his brother Malcolm, thereby preserving the tradition of cross-border respect among monarchs, without the subservience implied by the previous treaty. Crucially, Richard's act of restoring key castles, such as Roxburgh, Berwick, etc., to William, and the release of Scotland from all homage and allegiance to the English crown, symbolised the restoration of Scottish sovereignty. Also, all sons of nobles that were taken hostage were returned to the noble families, thus making the nobles a little bit more happier with William. This not only included the physical return of strategic fortifications, but also a symbolic reclaiming of Scotland's right to self-determination. The contemporary account of this agreement emphasises the significance of William's achievement, portraying it as an honourable liberation of Scotland from the oppressive yoke of English dominion. The nation and the narrative suggest that divine assistance played a role in this historic accomplishment, underscoring the period's prevalent belief in the intertwining of providence with the affairs of monarchs and nations. The nullification of the treaty through the Quit Claim marked a pivotal moment in Scottish history, restoring the kingdom's independence and altering the course of Anglo-Scottish relations. This act did not merely represent a diplomatic victory for William, also signified a broader restoration of Scottish pride and autonomy. The agreement laid the groundwork for a new phase of interaction between England and Scotland, one based on mutual recognition and respect, rather than subjugation and tribute. This momentous event in 1189 therefore stands as a testament to the complex interplay of medieval politics, personal ambitions, and the enduring quest for national sovereignty. From the annals of Roger de Hoveden comes the following extract. Accordingly, William, King of Scots, came to the King of England at Canterbury in the month of December, and did homage to him for his dignities in England, in the same manner that his brother Malcolm had held them. Richard, King of England, also restored to him the castle at Roxburgh and the castle of Berwick, freely and quietly to be held by him, and he acquitted and released him and all his heirs from all homage and allegiance, for the kingdom of Scotland to him and the kings of England for ever. This gift of his castles, and for quitting claim to all fealty and allegiance for the kingdom of Scotland, and for the charter of Richard, King of England, signifying the same, William, King of Scots, gave to Richard, King of England, 10,000 marks sterling. William and Scotland were now freed from the humiliating subjugation. The original treaty was handed over to William and presumably destroyed. A contemporary account of Scotland's regained independence declared that, by God's assistance, he, William, worthily and honourably removed his, Henry's heavy yoke of dominion and servitude from the Kingdom of Scots. So, here is the full charter of the King of England as to the liberties granted by him to William, King of Scotland. Richard, by the grace of God, King of England, Duke of Normandy and Aquitaine, and Earl of Anjou, to the Archbishop, Bishops, Abbots, Earls, Barons, Justices, Sheriffs, and by all his servants, faithful people throughout the whole of England, greeting. Know ye that we have restored to our most dearly beloved cousin, William, by the same grace of King of Scots, his castles of Roxburgh and Berwick, to be held by him and his heirs for ever as his own hereditary right. We have also acquitted and released him of from all convents and agreements which Henry, King of England, our father of happy memory, extorted from him by new charters and in consequence of his capture, upon condition, however, that he shall in all things do unto us as fully as Malcolm, King of Scots, his brother, did as a right unto our predecessors, and of right was bound to do. We likewise will do for him whatever right our predecessors did, and were bound to do for said Malcolm, both in his coming with a safe conduct to our court, and his returning from our court, and while he is staying in our court, and in making due provision for him, and according to him all liberties, dignities, and honours due to him as of his right, according as the same shall be asserted by four of our nobles, who shall be selected by us. And if any of our subjects shall, since the time when the said King William was taken prisoner by our father, have seized upon any of the borders or marches of the Kingdom of Scotland, without the same being legally adjudicated to him, then we do that we shall be restored to make him in full, and shall be placed in the same state in which they were before he was taken so prisoner. Moreover, as to his lands which he may hold in England, whether in demesne or whether in fee, that it is to say in the county of Huntingdon and in all other countries and counties, he and his heirs shall hold the same counties as fully and freely for ever as said Malcolm held or ought to have held the same, unless the said Malcolm or his heirs shall have since enfoffed any of the same, on the further condition also that if one shall be hereafter enfoffed of the same, the services or said fee shall belong to him or his heirs. And if our said father shall have given anything to William, King of Scots, we do will that the same shall be hereby ratified and confirmed. We have also restored to him all allegiances of his subjects, and all charters which the king our father obtained of him by the reason of his capture. And if of any of charters shall chance through forfeitness to have been retained by us, or shall hereafter be found, we do hereby order that the same shall be utterly void and of no effect. He has also become our leechman as to all the lands for which his predecessors were leechmen to our predecessors, and has sworn fealty to ourselves and to our heirs. The following being witness hereto: Baldwin, Archbishop of Canterbury; Walter, Archbishop of Rouen; Hugh, Bishop of Durham; John, Bishop of Norwich; Hubert, Bishop of Salisbury; Hugh, Bishop of Lincoln; Godfrey, Bishop of Winchester; Gilbert, Bishop of Rochester; Ranald, Bishop of Bath; Hugh, Bishop of Coventry; William, Bishop of Worcester; Eleanor, the King's mother; John, Earl of Mortagne, the King's brother, and many others. The signing of this quitclaim of Canterbury on the 5th of December 1189, which effectively annulled the treaty, represented a monumental victory for William and a pivotal moment in Scottish independence. This agreement not only signified the restoration and restoration of Scotland's sovereignty, but also marked the end of a period of humiliation and subjugation under English dominion. The emotions and reactions of William to this historic achievement would have been complex, ranging from profound relief to exorbitant joy. Imagine the overwhelming sense of accomplishment that must have coursed through William upon securing the quitclaim. After years of bearing the weight of England's overlordship, the restoration of Scottish autonomy would have felt like a personal triumph for William. It was a vindication of his relentless pursuit of independence and his diplomatic acumen. The joy of this moment would have been magnified by the knowledge that he successfully reversed the most demeaning aspects of the treaty, without restoring to open warfare, which could have further endangered Scotland's stability and prosperity. For William, the nullification of the treaty was a win completely. It was not just a diplomatic success, but it gave national pride back and sovereignty. He returned the key castles of Roxburgh and Berwick, and he reclaimed important symbols of Scottish power and governance. This victory, however, was not just for William personally, but for Scotland as a whole. It meant that the kingdom could once again chart its own course in history, free from the overbearing influence of English kings. The terms of the quit claim, requiring a payment of 10,000 silver marks, were a small price to pay for such a significant restoration of national autonomy. The strategic expenditure showcased William's willingness to utilise Scotland's resources judiciously to achieve long-term benefits for his realm. The Treaty of Fairlie, though it remained in force for merely 15 years, significantly shaped the trajectory of Anglo-Scottish relations. Its eventual successor, the Quitclaim of Canterbury, emerged from the need to supersede the treaty, reflecting the evolving landscape of medieval diplomacy categorised by the burgeoning use of written agreements. These documents, while pivotal, depended heavily on the willingness and ability of the ruling powers to enforce their terms. The secession of the treaty led to a re-establishment of the earlier norms of fealty and homage, a bit to a more personal basis, diverging from Henry's demand for allegiance to England itself, a more kind of allegiance to the king. So yes, the King of Scotland was still kind of underneath the Kingdom of England in the hierarchy, but did that really matter when Scotland was independent? This marked the end of England's direct dominion over Scotland, although it did not fully eliminate the underlying tensions or the Scots' resentment towards any semblance of subjugation. The lasting impact of Henry II's conquest, underscored by his visit to Thomas Becket's tomb, paradoxically did not solidify English control over Scotland, but instead contributed to shaping a distinct national identity for Scotland, particularly in ecclesiastical matters. The attempt to assert the Church of England's supremacy over the Scottish Church backfired. Disputes among English clergy provided an opening to an appeal for Rome, and as we know, that was successfully done, and Scottish bishops became under the direct autonomy of the Pope rather than England. The legacy of the treaty extended into territorial disputes over Northumbria as well, a sore point for William that persisted throughout his reign. Remember, he invaded England to regain some of the land in Northumbria and Cumbria that Malcolm, his brother, had given away. His inability to reclaim the earldom of Northumbria, despite repeated attempts and substantial offers, underscored the enduring challenges and frustrations of negotiating with successive English monarchs. William's efforts, rebuffed by Richard and later John, illustrated the ongoing complexities of Anglo-Scottish territorial policies. In reflection, however, the treaty and its revocation through the Quitclaim of Canterbury underscored the intricate dance of power. While the treaty's annulment temporarily averted direct English control, it set the stage for future confrontations, laying a foundation of uneasy peace that would eventually unravel, leading to the Scottish Wars of Independence. This period exemplifies a continuation and the continuous struggle for sovereignty and the lasting significance of those early diplomatic endeavours in shaping the national destinies of Scotland and England. Following William's return to Scotland, he turned his attention inward, focusing on consolidating his authority within Scotland furthermore. This period saw William assert his dominion over previously semi-autonomous or rebellious regions, effectively unifying the kingdom under his rule fully. One of William's notable achievements was securing his authority in Galloway. Oh, Galloway. As we know, the descendants of post-Fergus, Uhtred and Gilbert, were vying for control in the area. As we know, Uhtred was a close friend and advisor to William, but he was blinded, castrated, and had his tongue cut out by Gilbert, his brother, and he died not long after this. When Gilbert tried to appeal to Henry II of William's rule over Galloway, a delegation was sent to visit Gilbert, but shortly after the delegation discovered the fate of Uhtred, Henry's cousin, they rejected the request. Things went worse for Gilbert when he was forced to come to terms with the two kings. In 1176, Gilbert travelled into England, was fined 1,000 marks by Henry, and handed over his son, Donchad, into Henry's custody as a hostage to ensure good behaviour. Gilbert's reign is characterised by a large degree of hostility towards Scottish kings. Unlike his brother Uhtred, who was a friend of the incoming Normans and William, he maintained a Gaelic following. Such a policy made him popular in the province, but alienated him from his nominal Franco-Gaelic overlords. William cultivated the loyalty of Uhtred's son, Ronald, or Lochlann, using him as a card in the game for control over Galloway lordship. In the 1180s, tension between Gilbert and William was high, with Gilbert being known to have made frequent raids into Scottish-controlled territory of Eastern Galloway. When Gilbert died in 1185, and after the Treaty of Alluce was removed, this gave William an opening, even though he was at war. Gilbert's timely death, and with Donchad still in the custody in England, this eased the way for William to install Ronald, or Lochlann, as Gilbert's successor. The son of Uhtred, Lochlann, didn't get much of a highlight in our last episode covering the nobles of William, so let's do a bit of a deep dive into the man now. Lochlann, or Ronald, was the oldest son of Uhtred, Lord of Galloway, and William's friend and one of his greatest advisers. Ronald was likely a young adult at the time of his father's death at the hands of his uncle. He likely participated in King William Scotland's disastrous invasion of Northumbria. After his father's death, Ronald made it plain he considered King William of Scotland his liege. Where his father had declared himself King of Galloway after Gilbert's death in 1185, Ronald became Lord of Galloway. It is said his favourite title was yet to come, courtesy of his wife, however. Ronald married Helena, daughter of Richard de Morville, and eventually his sole heir. The couple had at least one known son, Alan of Galloway. Richard de Morville, Constable of Scotland, died in 1189, all of his sons having predeceased him. The title of Constable of Scotland and all of his Scottish estates passed to Lochlann, Ronald, through his marriage to Helena, and thus Ronald included the title of Constable of Scotland in his name. Constable of the King of Scots was a title Ronald preferred above all others, because it, wasn't sullied by his uncle Gilbert. After the death of his uncle in 1185, Ronald went about to seize the land of Gilbert's heirs. In this aim, he had to defeat the men who would defy his autonomy and authority in the name of Gilbert's heir. He seems to have done so, defeating the resistors who were led by a man called Gael Patrick. Yet resistance continued under a separate warrior from Galloway. Ronald's aims, moreover, encouraged the wrath of a more important political figure than any of the above. King Henry II of Scotland was outraged. Before he would die, a few years before Gilbert's death, Henry had taken his son and successor Donchad as a hostage, as we know. Hence, Henry was a patron and protector of the man Ronald was trying to disinherit. When William was ordered to visit Henry in southern Scotland, William was told Ronald must be stopped. However, William and Ronald were friends, and so in the end, Henry himself brought an army to Carlisle and threatened to invade unless Ronald would submit to his judgment. Ronald did so. As it transpired, Ronald kept most of Galloway, and Donchad was given the new Mormodun, or Earldom of Carrick, in compensation. More than any previous Lord of Galloway, he was the most loyal man and vassal of the King of Scotland. After all, he owed his lands to the positive influence of King William. Whereas Lochlann's grandfather, Fergus, had called himself King of Galloway, Lochlann's favourite title was Constable of the King of Scots. Ronald had led William's armies north into Scotland against the pretender Domhnall Mac Ullam, who claimed the Scottish throne as a grandson of King Donchad II of Scotland, if you remember a couple of episodes back. Lochlann defeated him in 1187 at the Battle of Mungaver, a mysterious location probably near Dingwall. Ronald, unlike his uncle Gilbert, welcomed French and England colonisation into his lands. In this, he was following his overlord, William, in all Davidonian Revolution aspects. Of all the Lords of Galloway, Ronald is the least mentioned in the Gaelic annals, suggesting that he had lost touch somewhat with his background in the world of Greater Irish Sea Gaeldom. He had five children. Alan of Galloway, who was his oldest son, who would succeed him to the Lord of Galloway and as Constable of Scotland, continuing a long tradition. Thomas of Galloway, who married Isabella, Countess of Athol. And then two other daughters and one third son, name unknown, who died young. In this, Uhtred's legacy lived on through his sons and grandsons, all thanks to his friend William's power shaping. There were other areas of discontent, as we mentioned a couple of episodes back, however. Moray and Inverness had long been centres of resistance against the Scottish crown, with local leaders frequently challenging royal authority. The insurrection in these areas was particularly fuelled by the Macheaths and the other local families who had a history of rebellion against the Scottish kings. The Macheaths in particular had a claim to the Mormondom of Moray and saw an opportunity to challenge William's authority during the periods of his captivity and the subsequent struggles with England. William responded after the treaty's annulment to these challenges with a combination of military force and diplomacy. He launched a series of campaigns aimed at subduing the rebels and restoring royal authority. By deploying his forces effectively and negotiating alliances with local leaders, William managed to quell the insurrection, reinforcing his control over these vital northern regions. Further extending his efforts to consolidate Scotland, William initiated another campaign in Caithness and Sutherland, regions in the far north of Scotland that had enjoyed a significant degree of autonomy. These campaigns were aimed at bringing these distant territories under the direct influence of the crown, a task that required both military intervention and the establishment of royal authority through the installation of loyal administrators, boroughs and castles. By successfully bringing Caithness and Sutherland under his control, William effectively unified the northernmost parts of Scotland with the rest of the kingdom. Thus, the achievement was not only expanded the territorial boundaries of his rule, but also demonstrated the reach of the Scottish crown, centralising efforts and bringing a vast and diverse land under a single authority. William's efforts to crush these revolts after the treaty's annulment over Galloway, Moray, Inverness, Caithness and Sutherland were pivotal in the process of building a unified Scottish kingdom. These actions, taken in the aftermath of securing independence from England, showcased his determination to strengthen and consolidate his reign internally. By extending royal control over regions that had previously eluded central authority, William laid the groundwork for a more integrated and cohesive Scottish state, setting the stage for future developments in Scottish governance and territorial administration. So, I think we'll leave our William there. Happy in his life, happy that he's restored Scottish independence and brought most of Scotland under his rule, centralising his grandfather, the Davidonian Revolution, further. As we conclude this week's journey through the pivotal moments of Scottish history, we find ourselves reflecting on the remarkable strides made by William in securing Scottish independence from English dominion. His tenure not only saw the reclamation of autonomy, but also unification of territories previously beyond the crown's reach. It's a profound legacy, one that speaks to William's determination, strategic acumen, and the enduring spirit of Scotland itself. Indeed, the landscape of Scotland, both political and physical, was altered under his rule, changes that would shape the nation's trajectory for generations to come. Yet, history teaches us the fluidity of peace and power. The notion that this trouble won't happen again remains a hopeful speculation rather than a guaranteed outcome, and I'm pretty sure some problems with England will happen again, as we're all aware. Now, as mentioned at the start of this 50th episode, to mark this occasion, we'll be hosting a special Q&A episode next time. This is your chance to ask anything you'd like, whether it's about me, the series, the future of the podcast, Scottish history, etc. Spotify listeners, remember, you can use a Q&A function available underneath this episode. Podbean listeners, you are encouraged to leave a comment under this episode on the Podbean app or the website. And for listeners on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or any other podcasting platforms, feel free to email your questions to historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com. That is historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com. Comment on this episode post on our Facebook group or make a post on the Facebook group. Or finally, you can tweet me at @thehistoryofse1. Your questions and engagement will be answered in our next episode next week in our Q&A. Our commitment to bring you weekly insights into Scotland's storied past remains unwavering, with our upcoming schedule adjusted to include 4 episodes this month, a testament to our dedication and treat for our listeners. As we continue to explore the depths of history, your feedback and engagement are invaluable. Please follow us on Twitter, as I said, at the History of SE1, or join our Facebook page to stay connected and informed. We're nearly on 100 members on the Facebook group, so thank you to all those members that have currently joined, and if you haven't already, feel free to give it a go. Before we part ways this week, consider leaving a review on the preferred podcast platform if you can. Your thoughts not only help us grow, but enable others to discover the rich history of Scotland. And remember, as always, our episodes are available across a broad spectrum of platforms, from Apple Podcasts to Spotify, Google Podcasts, Podbean, and many other great podcasting platforms and sites. Well, this has been a long one, reaching about 40 minutes. So, as always, thank you for joining us on this journey through the ages. As we pause at the close of William's chapter, let's carry forward the lessons of resilience, ambition, and unity that his legacy imparts. Have a fantastic week, guys, and we look forward to unraveling more historical narratives with you in our next episode. So until then, goodbye for now, and here's to the stories yet to be told. Stay safe, guys. Peace.